Welcome to day 15 of the Everyday Novelist NaNoWriMo Ride-Along, or as we like to call it, the Nano Gangbang. Today it is just Kitty and I, because everyone else is asleep. Because it's evidently been that kind of day everywhere.
It's the Ides of November.
Yeah, actually, I guess it is. The word counts from everybody who is sleeping are zero! I think we're in that part of the month. Because the word count from me is also zero! Because I spent all day rebuilding a really, really dumb snowblower and getting light shone in my eyes by someone who couldn't figure out how not to point the light in my eyes, so I got a migraine!
Oh, ruined my day. So, wait. Does that mean that I had the most words for the first time?
That means you win the day. How many words did you have, Kitty?
331.
Congratulations.
Which brings me just a touch over 4,000 words altogether, which I think this is the most I've written on any particular completed story ever. Not that it's complete yet, but that's still...
This is the longest piece you've ever written?
Yeah.
Nice. So the longest project you have ever written, that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How is the story going? Are you past that opening scene yet? Have you started to find the action?
Yeah, they're actually moving off the opening location to another location and trying to find missing members of their party at this point.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations are in order then, and you win the day.
Woohoo!
And since nobody else is here, and I'm not feeling all that great due to that whole migraine thing, I am going to pass you all off to the next part of that long and epic conversation we had that has been peppering the ends of these episodes for the last couple of days.
Sounds great.
Enjoy!
I know about, like, delivering anything to market, you know, and just how, it's a mad goose chase. So I kind of knew that approach to writing wasn't going to work, and I didn't just want to be another person writing, like, dinosaur porn or, you know, vampire... Or just another vampire story, right? It's like, you know, I was like, yeah, I think I can.
Did I ever tell you Down from 10 started off as a vampire story?
Did it really?
It really did.
Nice. The important part is it didn't end up as well.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to write to market and it had other ideas.
Yeah. Well, plus just the writing to market thing, it's so boring. Partly because the market is running around chasing the real things. Mm-hmm. Really.
It's like when you see a successful film in Hollywood, suddenly in the next 4 years, there's the same film over and over.
Exactly, yeah.
Same
tropes.
The market,
yeah, exactly.
And very rarely are any of those subsequent films any good at all, let alone better than the original.
Yeah, they're almost definitely within the bounds of the original. And so coming up with something that was interesting to me, kind of drawing more deeply on my personal character and experience rather than trying to serve the market, I had figured out that was going to be necessary. But I've still really been kind of caught up on how to temper that with who I'm writing to. Because I get caught, like sometimes I read something and, well, I get caught on the whole political correctness thing actually, where I'm writing something and I'm like, oh my God, like I'm going to get roasted for this.
Okay, I can solve that for you really easily.
All right,
look who's in the White House.
Yeah.
Actually, thank you.
He proves the old marketing point that all press is good press. It doesn't matter if people are talking about you in a bad way or in a good way. As Oscar Wilde says, there is only one thing worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about.
Yeah.
By the way, that's from Picture of Dorian Gray. Is it Picture or Portrait?
Picture, I think.
Picture of Dorian Gray.
Picture of Dorian Gray, which if you haven't read, those of you listening, you must. It is amazing. It is hilarious. It is incredibly creepy. Only Wilde could do that, both at the same time.
And if I remember, it's delightfully existential and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, especially for a new writer, there's no such thing as bad press.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Cory Doctorow, when he was trying to get his feet under him, he released all his manuscripts on the web under a Creative Commons license on the grounds that people were starting to pirate him anyway. And the biggest enemy of a young writer was obscurity.
Yeah.
Not piracy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and it worked for him. And it doesn't work for everybody, but that approach worked for him partly because he's major big guy in the hacker community. You know, he had the right mailing list to send the announcement to.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I liked listening to the Monster Hunter thing, because they're just it's just not politically correct at all. And I appreciate that, because it's kind of a Southern thing to not...
What's the Monster Hunter?
Larry Correa.
Oh, yeah. Larry, yeah.
So good. I was like, oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a Southern, because political correctness is a Yankee thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. It comes from New York and Boston. You can't get more Yankee than that.
Yeah. And as an anthropologist, like, when I teach, I am uber politically correct. That is how I am. Mm-hmm. Like, I still make little quips here and there, but, like, where I grew up, that's not a thing. Like, you make fun of everybody, you make fun of yourself, like it's self-deprecating humor, all of these things is what it's all about. And so I've really appreciated that kind of writing style, and that's sort of what I do, because that's just what I'm used to. But
I don't do politically correct very well. I don't think I could if I tried.
Yeah, I've had a rough few years. But I've gotten better, and I love everyone.
Academia. It's a tough crowd. It shares with Boston and New York high society stultified signaling social position with language and fashionable beliefs.
That's why really I've lost part of my accent as well.
Uh-huh.
Because I would constantly get made fun of.
Yeah, the amount of position. Placeholding that you do just to fit in that world is incredible.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons I didn't go into academia, even though I was primed for it my whole life and I actually really enjoyed being in it. Yeah. When I got close to it, I was like,
It's a tough business.
I eventually will not fit. Just won't.
I find that I do fit, but it feels not quite true to myself. Mm-hmm. But that's a different story.
Fortunately, it is a good age for rogue intellectuals.
So. Yeah. True. People do appreciate that, even within academia, I think.
Yeah.
But you have to be in that right spot to hit.
You swim in rogue intellectual circles and you get notes from people in academia saying, I wish I could say that.
But, you know, the students really appreciate it. I find that undergraduate students, if you're sort of rogue while you're teaching, they appreciate it because they feel the same way.
My favorite professors is the ones who are like, I don't care what you think. Here's what I think.
And come at me. Like, I want to hear you argue with me. That's what I want.
And also the ones who would, even though they didn't believe it, would deliberately take up a contrary position to make you learn the material well enough to refute them.
Mm-hmm. Those are so much
devil's advocate. Yep. You gotta play it.
So don't worry about political correctness too much.
Yeah.
There are some things that I'm like, I will never cross. There are some of those bridges that I say no. Well, but
what I've discovered is actually the bridges that I don't want to cross in my fiction, I'm just making those bridges I don't want to personally cross myself. It's like, oh, I don't actually want to write a story about that, or I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to. And then it's like, all right. I mean, there are plenty of, you know, interesting and fascinating. And that's kind of my new filter for where to go is like, don't look outside. Just look in and be like, actually, it's going to take me a year to write that story. And I'm going to be depressed the whole time. Maybe I'll lighten up a little.
Yeah. <You know? laughs> True. Yeah.
I do it the other way around. If I'm not interested in it, I won't write about it. But if it's a bridge that I don't want to cross, it goes on my list of things I eventually have to write about. Because usually, for me anyway, that means that there's something really interesting there that will make for a very powerful story. But sometimes I have to grow into it. There's a couple of those that I'm working on right now that I've been sitting on for 20 years because I couldn't figure out how to go there, or it was just too scary.
Glad you brought that up. Yeah, there are some stories that I've thought of that I say I will either never do this, or I have to be like probably 50 or 60, 70 years old before I even try to touch this. Like, I need time to even think of that idea. And I'll just write it down or take a voice memo and just let it be. Mm-hmm. Because I know that me, as my 30-something, 20-something, just kidding, 30-something-year-old self. My 30-something-year-old self, I just can't touch that for right now. I don't have the experience nor the smarts to do that right now. Yeah. So
this big series that Kitty's been editing and that I'm working on, I first tried writing that when I was 15. And I came back to take another pass at it when I was 20. That's when it turned into an actual novel from a series of short stories. Then I came back and took another pass at it in 2006, 2007. And now I'm finally doing it. I'm finally the writer that can tackle that story. I'm still getting used to that. Yeah. Part of me is afraid that I'm going to get halfway through book five of the six and be like, nope, not ready for it yet.
Gotta wait another 8 years. Yeah.
But no, this time I'm going to make it through no matter what happens. But it took a long time because every time I'd grow into the part that I hadn't grown into before, I'd find something else. Interesting. Some things are like that. I mean, this book I'm writing for Nano this month, I would never have dared to touch a book like this even 2 years ago. In fact, I think you remember I told you I would never write a dystopia because I found them boring and dangerous at the same time. Mm. Well, now I'm writing a dystopia. And it's way scarier than anything I ever imagined that I could do in a dystopia. But 30-odd years of studying cults and repressive regimes and political propaganda, and in the last 10 years having read Ilul and Goebbels and the whole gamut and Mao, it's ready. And I didn't even know that I was preparing to write this book, but here it is.
I love that we're talking about being ready to write some things or not, because that's something I've been running into where with the story I'm working on, the epic, I'm not ready to write it. So part of what I'm building in is like I'm writing as much as I can and figuring out as much as I can because there's a lot I can figure out. And then I'm educating myself. Like I'm just reading. Yeah. And it's partly to tell the story and partly because there are just gaps that I know that I have in my education, you know, that I've wanted to fill for a long time. And so it's kind of like these two things kind of fit together. It's intimidating, though. Like I'm starting on something that I'm almost certain I won't be able to finish. Now, I may be able to go through the story in such a way, keep it personal enough and small enough that the things that I know I won't be able to pull off, I can go around them. I may be able to do that, and I will try to do that.
With the right point of view character, you can sometimes pull that kind of thing.
And I think both of my point of view characters I can, because what they're about isn't so much the political environment that they're in and they're affecting. It's just the type of people they are that make things happen. And I actually may be able to pull it off, but I'm still kind of educate myself on like the dynamic, because one of the things I have to look up the dynamics of cults and religions. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I grew up religious, but I need to study a little bit more anthropologically, you know, mm-hmm. how they work and how charismatic leaders work and different things like that.
The book you want to pick up is called The Wrong Way Home. I'll send you an email with the link, and those of you listening, it'll be linked to in the show notes. The definitive psychological study on cults.
Interesting.
Studies both cult leaders and people who buy into cults and the different things that drive them and the way that the dynamic satisfies both.
Interesting.
I think it's really great that you bring that up, that you're having to learn all of these different things, because that's one thing you don't necessarily, well, I'm obviously coming at this from like a totally research point of view, my poor soul, but like when you're writing something that's even like creative, like you want to make it believable, you have to do research. Yeah. And so like that is something that you don't necessarily think of right off of
Agreed.
The bat.
Agreed.
Like, oh, I'm just going to go in, I'm going to write, it's going to be great. And then you have to think, oh man, I don't know a whole lot about this. Let me research this. And so it takes you so much longer.
Yeah.
But also you want to make it believable and real. And something that people can look, that people can look up and go, oh wow, that is a real thing. That is kind of cool.
Yeah. And there comes a point where the research begins creating the stories for you.
Absolutely.
And that's a wonderful point to hit. Then you have too many stories to choose from, but they're all growing out of the stuff that you've learned in the last couple of years. So it's all fresh and sparkly, and it's a wonderful thing.
It's cool stuff.
But that, I love that you mentioned that, Tori, because the existential writer problems that I've been facing most recently is the research thing, actually. Like, I've been having a lot of fun. I've been jumping in, doing a lot of research, you know, going down those lovely Wikipedia rabbit holes and really enjoying it. But that doesn't fit with my personal mythos of what it is to be a writer. What it is to be a writer is to sit down filled with inspiration that's all your own, you know, completely separate from the world, and then you pour forth this brilliant on the page, you know, which, ha ha ha, right? It doesn't work that way.
No, I think that's crucial. It's something that even coming from a research route, I didn't realize as I started writing. And then I was like, this is scary. I have to actually start researching this that I know nothing about. And so,
yeah.
But it gives it that level of, I don't know, it gives it extra oomph. Like we were talking about, it's believable, it's real, it's based in reality, which is important for, I think, a lot of people.
For sure.
A lot of readers.
It also, because it's fresh and new to you, you bring the experience of that freshness to your readers.
That's true. I didn't think of that.
And it wakes up parts of you that are old that you're used to, but because it interacts with those parts, they become fresh to you as well. And that's something that that you can't get. If you don't have something about a story that's stretching you, there's going to be very little there that's going to awaken you, that you're going to bring fresh to the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes good sense. And my on the street of experience of running into this, it's kind of hilarious, but it might also be useful to somebody listening, is that I do this research and I sit down and then I write like the sort of the default cliche that comes into my head. An example is that I'm writing a corner store in South San Francisco. And so the cliched version of the corner store is the proprietor, the fellow who owns the store, is an Indian immigrant, you know, from India. And I was like, okay, that's believable enough. But I've been researching Iran and Iranian culture, and it's there's so much wonderful. And, you know, and learning about the whole revolution and the Arab invasion and all that. And a lot of Iranians came to San Francisco, was actually one of the places for the Iranian diaspora. And I was like, oh, I want to include that in. So like, oh my God, I just did all this research. I even know something about the food and like the shish kebab and like, you know, the different thing, which aren't shish kebabs, there's a different word for it, but you know, the different food. So I can just put that in. And I was like, yeah, that's perfect. But my emotional response to that, with this sort of fairy tale idea of what it means to be a writer and to create everything originally myself, was sort of resentment, right? I'm just like, oh, because I originally wrote it with like, you know, the cliche, right, of the Indian fellow owning the corner store. So that's what I had to go through. And myself as a writer, is I'm like, no, like, let me put in this rich research that's interesting and relevant. I just learned about it and it's exciting. And I'm glad that you mentioned, Dan, kind of the value of that, because I didn't really see the value aside from the fact that I care about it, you know, and I had just spent all that time learning about it. So now I really care about, like, you know, and I know something about Iranians fleeing the circumstances in Iran and try to make better lives somewhere else. So
there's an apocryphal tale about Edgar Allan Poe that he was trying to write The Raven and he couldn't make it work. So he killed his wife in order to have grief to work from. Now, it's not true. But it inspired probably the best single line about creativity I have ever heard. From U2's song The Fly, every artist is a cannibal, every poet is a thief, all kill their inspiration and then sing about their grief. Because it's true.
Interesting. I think it, for some reason, it has to be true.
Well, because you can't. I mean, we've all gone through stuff. Like, all of our different stuff. And it is very true. You can't really comprehend what somebody's going through unless you go through that same thing or something extremely very similar.
But also that creativity is, in some senses, it's like a carrion bird. We work with the remains of the dead around us, you know, whether it's our own dead and buried experiences or the ideas of people that they've written down and then gone on with things. We pick apart the world around us and fuse it into new forms.
Or even if it's something like a burst of inspiration that you put down and then you look at it a little later and it's most garbage, you know.
Yeah.
But you can take something out of it, right?
But
sorry,
it's like,
I'm remembering a story.
But wait, what if it's like other people are reading this garbage, like this burst of whatever, this amalgamation of stuff, and they're like, that's how I should feel when whatever happens. And then we're just creating this whole thing. Like, that's a lot of power.
In our head, I like that.
I'll have to send you, I read an article recently, if I can find it again, I'll send it to you and I'll link it on the show notes, about the way that the competition between Dostoevsky and Tolstoy shaped the Russian Revolution and 20th century politics is really stunning.
I want to read that.
Yeah.
I have my theory that artists and storytellers are sort of this hidden priesthood, cultural priesthood.
Absolutely. I mean.
That's what mythology is. Mythology is the scripture of a dead religion.
Damn, we spent years and years and years as anthropologists and archaeologists studying scribbles. basically, mm-hmm. from people who may or may not have been on drugs. I mean, let's be honest.
it's time traveling telepathy. Yeah. The word is.
Yeah.
Oh, that was it. That your the flash of inspiration reminds me. Okay, I had a youth leader when I was a kid at church, right? He tells this story at church, which was hilarious. It was supposed to be a don't do drugs story about his party days. He was blitzed out of his mind on acid, and then someone spiked the orange juice with something else.
Oh, no.
So it was a cocktail that he never would have taken on his own, and he doesn't know what it was. But right as he's starting to pass out, he suddenly understands the whole universe. And he scrambles across the room looking for a piece of paper to write it down on before he passes out. And he finds one and he writes it down and he passes out.
Is it 42?
No, unfortunately. The next morning, he didn't wake up till everyone else had woken up and left. That tells you how blitzed he was. And he gets up, makes himself breakfast, and halfway through his coffee, he remembers, I wrote it down. I knew what it was, and I wrote it down. So he goes to the desk, and he rifles through the papers, and he finds it, and he reads it, and it says, something smells like shit in here.
Oh, God.
Accurate.
Those words will be spoken through the halls of that. Wow.
Yes. And that's kind of how I feel about a lot of the things, really, things that come to me and I write down. I'm like, oh my God, yes, I'm going to be a great author someday. It's going to start here. And then, a week later, that idea is like long gone because I'm actually developing the story and like working on something else. And, you know, I still embrace the inspiration.
Oh, of course. Well, and the feeling of inspiration is fantastic. But to extend the metaphor, I actually then stole that story and put it in one of my books. Nice. So those of you listening who've read that book, there's a reason that story sounds familiar.
Oh, man.
And that will be it for us today. Tomorrow we're coming back and I am going to try to knock some socks off again because I need to get back on this horse before I completely blow the month. I'm expecting I'll have some healthy competition from those who are out of service today, especially from Kitty, who is starting to catch fire over there. And I actually hear that Dee Dee and Ben are starting to catch fire as well, though they weren't able to write today. So we will find out tomorrow. See you then. The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Support this podcast and keep us going. Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join up.